Today, Howard Bellman will be presenting his program, Collective Bargaining for Government Workers in Wisconsin, The Challenge of Democracy in the Workplace. And I'd just like to remind everybody that we don't want to have anybody standing on their chairs or on the soapbox today. We're here to be informed and educated by Mr. Bellman, and hopefully we can keep the political conversation down a little bit. Although I know that's never a problem. Over the years since 1965, Mr. Howard Bellman has mediated in nearly every category of dispute. His work has ranged from the most ordinary civil and labor matters to international diplomacy. A significant portion of his practice has included high-profile, multi-party cases of public concern, such as controversial land use determinations, large-scale environmental remediations, school district desegregation, statewide education financing litigation, and Indian land claims. He's been appointed as a master or other court adjunct by federal and state courts, including the Supreme Court of Ohio. He received the 2003 Lifetime Achievement Award of the American College of Civil Trial Mediators. Mr. Bellman received his BA in law degrees from the University of Cincinnati and an LLM in labor law in 1963 from New York University. He's a distinguished adjunct professor at Marquette University's Center for Dispute Resolution Education, and has lectured at many universities worldwide, and we're very happy to have him lecturing for us today. Mr. Bellman was a member of the Wisconsin Employment Relations Commission by appointment of Governor Patrick Lucey in 1973 to 1976, and the Secretary of the Wisconsin Department of Industry, Labor, and Human Relations in the cabinet of Governor Anthony Earl from 1982 to 1986. And as we all know, this is a topic that is close to many of our hearts, so we warmly welcome Howard Bellman.
Well, thank you, Nick. I'm more than honored by the invitation, and it's so nice to meet all of you. I can assure you that I've worked in a broad variety of venues, but this is a first. And so that's very enjoyable for me and very flattering. I'm also sensing the sincerity of your invitation here, and I appreciate that a lot. Sometimes I work among people who are not as sincere as all of that, and I understand that as well, but I appreciate the difference. When I was still a student, and now you know how long ago that was, sometime during the Punic Wars. when I was still a student, I came to believe that since most American adults work about 8 hours a day and sleep about the same amount, the nature and quality of their work lives pretty much characterizes the nature and quality of their lives. And to the extent that they are going to have democracy in their lives, that is to say that they are going to have some opportunity to be influential about the quality of their lives, then they're going to have democracy in their work lives. That seemed to me to be a valid proposition. And I also came to learn very early on that if in fact one is to have, most of us are to have democracy in our work lives, we are going to have to be organized. You need to be unionized. Unless you are a shortstop or a eminent surgeon or an extraordinary artist, we do not, as individuals, have much power in the labor market. And if we are to have that sort of influence, it will be because we are working in concert with those with whom we work. So at that point, I was drawn to labor law as an opportunity to earn a living and to earn a living idealistically. But I learned not long after, no surprise to anyone, I suppose, now, that in reality, there are bullies and victims and are sites of bad types all around the bargaining table on both sides of the management labor equation, and that at least for me the most comfortable position in that landscape was that of a mediator and arbitrator. So that's what brought me in 1965 from Detroit where all of my work was in the private, with private sector employers and unions, the unions of the private sector employers, to Wisconsin, where there was a job opening for a lawyer slash mediator slash arbitrator in state government, and where collective bargaining for public employees, teachers and cops and firefighters and public works employees, was being pioneered. I think you should know that some Wisconsin public employees have been organized and influential in affecting the policies and practices of their employers for decades. But in 1959, while Gaylord Nelson was governor, and a newly energized Democratic Party was starting to realize its potential, a statute like no other statute in the United States, a statute of no more than two or three sentences, was enacted, providing that such public employees not only were allowed to organize and make demands of their employer, but had the right to do so, to organize and demand bargaining over wages, hours, and working conditions. I'm guessing, because I wasn't here in 1959, that this was a response by a grateful governor and his party to the protests of public sector workers that saw themselves and portrayed themselves as compared to their private sector counterparts as second-class citizens, deprived of the democracy in the workplace guaranteed in the private sector by federal labor laws that had been in place since the middle 1930s. Still, that unprecedented enactment in Wisconsin hardly compared to the federal law. It was in a sense a token, a gesture by comparison. It was essentially a brief sort of quotation from the federal law of two or three sentences. And it's very important to understand why that was the case, why the whole federal law was not simply replicated by Gaylord, Governor Nelson, and by the Democratic legislature at that point. And this is the bit of information that I think is most important for me to try to impart here. Private sector labor law, the law that public sector employees claimed would give them full citizenship, private sector labor law requires employers to bargain in good faith, but says very little about how difficult negotiations will be resolved. Private sector labor law assumes and supports the economic combat that we know as strikes and lockouts as the ultimate arbiter of negotiation outcomes. I would compare it to the rules for boxing, the Marquess of Queensberry rules. It organizes the contest and then allows the beating. Of course, private sector labor and management usually settle rather than destabilize their ongoing relationship or test their powers and risk the continuity of earnings and productions, but that's what the labor law that has been in effect here since in the United States since the 30s contemplates. But in 1959, when Governor Nelson and the legislature were enacting the public sector law, the very first in the country, and ever after that, even as the public sector labor law has grown to be even more comprehensive and elaborate than the private sector model, there has been an abiding anxiety among our political leaders of both parties that there is a real possibility of excessive union power. A fear that even the threat of strikes, when combined with union political activism, would overwhelm our governmental processes. That unions would, quote unquote, elect the government management, and then threaten it to support their demands. So it has always been the case in Wisconsin that strikes by government workers are prohibited. And the private sector model has never been replicated here. As a consequence of this partial adoption of the private sector model, I think the public sector labor law in Wisconsin from 1959 to 2011 has been in a state of unresolved controversy and flux, quite the opposite of its private sector model, because the private sector model, absent the right to strike, if you take the right to strike out of the private sector model, it's an unworkable concept. It lacks a vital organ. It has no engine. Pick your metaphor. And has been in constant need of revision. It may be the case that no session of the Wisconsin legislature since the enactment of this law has not revised the law. That's how dynamic and controversial and unstable that law has always been. And it's important to know that some years ago, when our public sector unions would strike, despite the prohibition, they came to understand that, in fact, such raw power could cause them to lose. The unions themselves became the advocates of arbitration as an impasse resolution procedure that would substitute for the strike in the law. Some of you may remember the Milwaukee firefighters strike. Some of you may remember the Hortonville teacher strike. That was followed by the advocacy, not for the right to strike, but for interest arbitration by the public sector unions. But as it turns out, that revision of the model, of the private sector model, did not limit the controversy. Arbitration, among other things, turns over one of the most important decisions of elected policymakers, the labor costs that are included in their budgets, to an outside, unelected person. That seems to many to be a distortion of the general democratic processes in our communities. So the story here is of a multi-generation effort to implement an ideal, democracy in the government workplace, that has been fraught with controversy. Controversy present even in its earliest formulations, as policymakers have attempted to reconcile this ideal with their anxieties over the possibility of union domination of government. And to do so, starting with a private sector model that's not really apt. So I would add a very important exacerbating factor. In the early years of this experimentation, these developments were guided by a particularly civil and constructive political dialogue, mainly among the representatives of the unions and public management, not among elected officials. They seemed to understand the needs of the relationships that they served and the inevitability of the turning of the political worm. In recent years, however, we have veered into a much different style that I would describe as kicking the pendulum. As they have moved, both parties, into and out of power in the Capitol, the raw exercise of power, rather than constructive dialogue, has been the modus operandi. Now, one party that seems to view itself as overwhelmingly powerful, and without any reference to those who have usually suggested policy to conservative elected policymakers, has kicked the pendulum so hard as to essentially go even beyond the place where my story began. It's as if the pendulum has swung beyond the 12. Remember, even before the pioneering law of 1979, there was some voluntary collective bargaining with government employees in Wisconsin. I've seen full-blown collective bargaining agreements from places like Manitowoc County that were entered in the late 1930s, because snowplow drivers in Manitowoc County understood they had some bargaining power. and they knew when to exercise it. Still, it would appear that in the very near future, I mean, I had no idea when I accepted this invitation where that future was exactly, but in the very near future, meaningful collective bargaining will be prohibited. There was a time when it was not statutorily supported, but it was allowed. Now we're going to a time when it is literally prohibited. And that's what I mean about the pendulum swinging over the 12. I would not have predicted this. It seems to me like a sneak attack. But more interesting to me has been the response of union members and their supporters. The response seems consistent with the profound proposition that essential democracy is at risk. It is easily and often observed that unionism in the United States is at a very low point in our history. The contemporary economy seems incompatible with union growth. Union leaders have done little to teach their members why unions are needed. Employers have learned to avoid the abuses of their predecessors. Protective laws seem to supplant the protections otherwise provided by collective bargaining agreements. I would have characterized union members in 2011 as somewhere in the range of apathetic to cynical in their attitudes toward their bargaining agents. And I would have been wrong. They seem to recognize the significance of placing the right to collective bargaining at risk. Their criticism of unions has been eclipsed by their anxiety over being subjects of an uncaring and even mean-spirited regime. They seem to have been organized by their perceived abuser, and more effectively than their advocates could ever do. At least that's how it has looked to me in recent months, but I have also learned how unreliable my intuitions are in these matters, so I'm not predicting anything. Now, I understand that I have not offered a proposal for addressing the flawed concepts that have kept the political pot boiling throughout the history of public sector collective bargaining in Wisconsin. But I hope that you agree that even a flawed process that recognizes that democracy should prevail in the workplace is far superior to abandoning the goal of democracy in the workplace, and that we should continue to face the challenges of that objective, not walk away from it. So thank you for your invitation and for your attention. And I understand there's maybe an opportunity for some discussion.
There might be just a few questions. Everyone will just be patient.
I was actually hoping for a few. I was hoping for a few answers. Well, let me just say, I've already confessed that I'm a lawyer. But I will also tell you that I was very disappointed by what just happened in the Supreme Court. Okay. I don't want to say that I was terrifically surprised, but I was very disappointed. I think that the case that you're referring to in the federal courts is even more difficult to be entirely confident about than that case was. And I want to be careful here because I haven't read the briefs or any of that sort of thing, but my understanding of that case is that it is based on the United States Constitution, not on statutes. And the notion that somehow in the construction of the amended public sector law, the law that's about to go into effect here apparently, there is a disparate treatment among categories of public employees which disparate treatment offends the Constitution. I just wish I were more confident about that theory. I can't tell you how, I can't exaggerate how sad the state of affairs makes me, and I think sad's the right word. I mean, if you care about my emotional state. But somewhere in my mediator's grounding, in my mediator's mentality, is the notion that we have to cling to some value that we place on moderation. Okay? And so sort of exaggerated characterizations, demonizing of people is uncomfortable for me. Okay? So the idea that someone who with whom we disagree, no matter how strongly we disagree, is a criminal makes me a little uncomfortable as a mediator. Okay? Now, I'm not a common species, I'm a mediator. Okay? So I'm not prescribing this. I'm just telling you that for me, my mentality is one that braces a little bit with notions of jailing people with whom we don't agree. Okay. I think that the kind of work that I do has the value of allowing us helping us settle disputes. And what I mean is that, and I mean to distinguish between disputes, like let's say strikes, and conflicts, by which I mean ideological perspectives that are diverse. So that to me, it is perfectly legitimate and even possibly ironically healthy that there are very conflicting perspectives that are allowed to exist in our culture. I worry about developing a culture where everybody is required to think the same way. Okay? I would be somebody who would have a difficult time in that sort of orthodoxy. But we need to manage our disputes that bubble up from those underlying conflicts, because I think our society gets threatened when we can't stand disputing anymore. We go for an authority that will put a lid on conflict. You know, I mean, this may seem like a terrible digression, but let me just say, as I look around the room and I see people who are more or less my age, I think some of you might remember Tito, right? And I remember reading as a kid in the National, not such a kid, in the National Geographic about how Tito had taken all those warring countries into Yugoslavia and everybody was getting along, okay? And then Tito died and all hell broke loose, okay? What Tito did was he put a lid on it. He suppressed it. He punished those whose views were not orthodox. And so they lived without disputes, which externally looked like harmony, but it was oppression. That's what I worry about. The valuable idea is that we should preserve our capacity to harbor conflict, but not be so troubled by the disputes that bubble up from it that we demand a government that oppresses us for our unorthodox perspectives. Okay? So that's how I tend to justify myself and how I can say to myself, look at all the really bad people you've gotten along with over 50 years of mediating. Okay? I wonder at that sometimes. Anyway, that's my rationalization. A long one. Many of you have probably at least heard of, if not read, Getting to Yes, a book from Cambridge, Massachusetts. Need I say more? Getting to Yes describe something called, what I would call interest-based bargaining, which is what I think the same thing that you're talking about, which seems more intellectual, more efficient, less heated, more respectful of relationships than the bargaining that most of us are familiar with, which is called positional bargaining. I don't know how much you want to get into the technology of all of this, but when you go to buy your next car, you'll lie to the car salesman about what you're willing to pay. He'll know you're lying, and you'll know that he knows you're lying. And you will proceed from there because he's doing the same thing to you. Okay? So this is a typical American exercise when we sell our houses or when we buy our cars. And it's a sort of a dance that everybody understands, and it's inefficient, and it causes us to undermine relationships and so on and getting to yes. Let me just say that if it works for you, it works for you. I would only add to your description of that era that you're pining for, that was during the Thompson administration, and the main union of employees, public employees in the state, was the Wisconsin State Employees Union. That very union and the preceding in the Doyle administration were in such incredible conflict that it probably is one of the things that precipitated the circumstance that we're in now. So I don't know exactly how those things develop. I don't know why it was easier for that union, not your union, but that other bigger union, to get along with Governor Thompson than it was to get along with either Governor Earle or Governor Doyle. There are nuances and subtleties and currents that are beneath the surface. And exactly what are the causes and what are the effects is sometimes hard to know. But I would say that whether or not interest-based bargaining is the prescription for all collective bargaining, they certainly could have used some of it during the last legislative session in the legislature. And there were offers. And there were offers of mediation that were turned down, including by Republicans. Okay, so we're in a particular circumstance. Well, I won't be surprised if that happens in Madison or Milwaukee or Racine or Green Bay, maybe some other places. But what Hortonville demonstrated was that for public employees, the right to strike is like the right to set yourself on fire. Okay? It destroyed them. That's why Loftus, and some of you might remember Eddie Durkin, the famous fire chief of Madison and vice president of the International Association of Firefighters, advocated and in a certain sense invented the arbitration process, which, as I said earlier, is in and of itself not perfect. But in a school district with 30 teachers, or 50 teachers, or 15 teachers, which is the typical Wisconsin school district, where there are lots of unemployed teachers happy to take their jobs, a strike is not a wise strategy. And Hortonville demonstrated that, sadly. It was a mistake to start something they didn't know how to finish. And so I don't know what's going to happen. I would say that those of us who live in big communities like Madison with big, powerful, energetic, spirited unions like the Madison Teachers don't know what to look forward to, and it might be pretty inconvenient. But for the state in general, and I say this understanding that there are political leaders who don't really care what happens in Madison, I think is part of the syndrome that we're experiencing. It's a different story because of the smallness of the bargaining units. I don't see bargaining proceeding. I don't see it. I guess we are all entitled to define bargaining as we will. Okay, and some people will say about certain kinds of meetings that I go to, that's not really bargaining, it's something else. In terms of what I would think of as sort of authentic bargaining in good faith, where there's some give and take back and forth across the table, it's hard to imagine under the circumstances of the bill that's about to pass, about to be signed. I just don't see it. I would say that, but I want to add something else that I think is responsive to an observation by you, and that has to do with being equal. There's always references in these conversations to the notion of the level playing field. That's the expression people use. We need a level playing field, and then we can negotiate. Or that's where negotiations ought to occur, on a level playing field. I can tell you, after 50 years, I've never seen a level playing field. A level playing field is like a vacuum. It's an intellectual concept that you never will encounter in real life. So we all operate all the time in an uneven power distribution. And that's what we learn to work in, and that's what we learn to overcome. Okay, in other words, we feel abused by the maldistribution of power, and so we organize, or we save our money, or we go to school, or whatever it is that takes to empower you. But it's never equal. Okay, and so that's why there's a sort of perpetual nature to this process, if it's allowed. And I think that that's also why some of members of our community don't want to allow it, because they don't see any end to it. I think it was Samuel Gompers, the old iconic labor leader, who was asked by, maybe it was John L. Lewis, asked by in a congressional hearing, just what is it you're after? To which he answered, more. let me just say that I don't know the panorama of consequences that might occur at a public employee strike in Wisconsin, but they would at very least include being fired. Okay, and that's why I think these strikes may occur anyway in Milwaukee or Madison, because you cannot fire all the teachers and replace them. But if you had 40 teachers or 15 teachers, you could. Okay. So I think that there probably would also be really stiff fines and a variety of other things that would happen in the case of the illegal strikes. The private sector is a different matter. The private sector, as compared to what it was like when I got started, I didn't know it at the time, of course, but over the span of my career, it has gone from its peak in the history of the United States to its almost its depths. That's how precipitous has been the decline of unionism in the American private sector. I started out working in Detroit. Names that you'll recall, Walter Reuther and Jimmy Hoffa, were at full tilt. There were no Volkswagens. Whole industries like printing and construction were universally organized. Okay, and I thought as a young guy that was nature's way, and it would only grow. The very opposite happened, so that the percentage of private sector unions that are representing employees these days is very, very small, and I'm sure they see that they are vulnerable. Even must have seen that before this happened in Wisconsin. It must be even more vivid for them now. Whether they have the capacity to respond is really the question. I hope they do. Yeah, I think it's a lot of things. I think it's the nature of the economy. I think it's the inability, the failure of union leaders to explain themselves, to explain unionism to workers as new cohorts of workers came through the ranks. I think it's because unions have advocated for protective laws, so the collective bargaining agreements don't mean as much as they used to. When I went to law school, if you didn't have a collective bargaining agreement, you had no protection at all. Since then, all sorts of laws against, let's say, discrimination have passed that didn't exist in the 60s. It's just a variety of factors, some of which are easily, that might be dealt with strategically, and some of which I think cannot be dealt with strategically. But lots of reasons. Employers are smarter than they used to be about these things. Yeah, bargaining and negotiations and mediation, which is just a subset of that, is a strategy. And no strategy works for everything. I would never say that. They should mediate everything. I've had lots of opportunities to go places and said, and had to tell people I don't think I could help them. I don't think that the people you're talking about and you're describing as ideological and not bargaining in good faith have any intention of being otherwise. That's not an embarrassment to them. Okay, that's exactly what they wanted to be, and they're proud of it, and they got support for being that way. I would stop short of saying what the next strategy ought to be. That's not my topic. But if to the extent that you are suggesting that the response to what we are, that is what is worrying us in the room right now, the response ought to be something other than negotiation, I'm not dissenting. I would say, however, that at some point in time, if all goes well by my lights, somebody's going to sit down and rewrite the labor law. Okay, so that the crucible in which labor and management interacts will be reconstructed. And that when that arena is designed, it will be designed in a way to allow the kind of bargaining that is more like a marriage than the other kind. Because for those of us who think unionism is essential, we don't think that it arrives at a point where it becomes obsolete, but rather that it is an element of a continuing, eternal relationship, a for better or for worse, till death do us part kind of a relationship. So we need to have a style of negotiations that is mindful of preserving the relationship. And I think at best, collective bargaining has been just that. Thank you.